Hello and welcome to South Asia Chat, a podcast proudly brought to you by the Institute of South Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore. I'm Iqbal Singh Sivya, Director at the Institute. On today's episode, we have an extremely special guest. It is my pleasure today to have the opportunity to speak with the Minister of External Affairs of India, Dr. S. Jaishankar, on India and its position in the evolving international order. Dr. S. Jaishankar truly needs no introduction. As I mentioned, he is the Foreign Minister, he's the Minister of External Affairs of India. And before assuming the position of the Minister of External Affairs in 2019, he was the Foreign Secretary of India. He is one of the most preeminent diplomats of India, and in that capacity has served as Ambassador and High Commissioner to China, the United States of America, Singapore, and the Czech Republic. And he's also recently published his second book, Why Bharat Matters. So, Dr. Jaishankar, congratulations on the book, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Iqbal. It's good to be back in Singapore. Good to be back with ISAS.
It's a pleasure. And since you mentioned good to be back to ISAS, I should plug a little bit about ISAS as well. Mm-hmm. ISAS had the distinguished honor of hosting Dr. Jaishankar as a distinguished visiting research fellow before he went back to assume the position of the Minister of Foreign Affairs. So, Minister, may I start our discussion with a very broad question?
Sure.
And feel free to take it in any direction that you like. The world today is going through deep transformation. We are witnessing crises of multilateralism, deep divisions between the North and South, which are in fact escalating as mm-hmm. well. We're also noticing what we perhaps could describe as a redistribution of power between states. My question would be, how does India perceive this scenario? And how is India poised to play a greater role looking ahead?
Well, first of all, I agree with you. I think we are in a crisis. It's a slow-moving crisis, but nevertheless a crisis. Sometimes doesn't always move slow. Essentially, what has happened is that the reality of the world has undergone a profound change. So if you look what are the major economic producers, consumers, who's relevant to connectivity, to logistics, to technology, these are not the countries who you would have picked in 1945. Okay. First of all, there are more countries, four times as many countries. I mean, from 50 who were there when UN was created, you have almost 200 now. So the foundations have changed, but yet the structures in many cases remain the same. So there's obviously a tension out here. If we are to see a more efficient world, because at the end of the day, if there's one word with anybody associates with Singapore, it's efficiency, okay? So if I would say you want to see a more efficient world, you have to align the structures with the foundations. You can't have an 80-year-old structure sitting on a 80-day-old foundation. Mm. Simple as that. And you ask me, how does India see it? Frankly, India sees it as an opportunity. That this is a time we ourselves can do things. We can do more things with other people. We speak also for a bigger constituency. So in many ways, today we are the voice of change in the world. Mm.
And if I could pick up from the thread of voice of change,
mm-hmm.
India has been very vocal about the need for reform of multilateral institutions and multilateralism generally. In your view, what type of reforms are needed to make multilateralism really work? Or are we at a stage at which minilateralism and plurilateralism is the way forward for the world?
Well, minilateralism and plurilateralism is the way so long as multilateralism remains gridlocked. I was doing from the Indian perspective, a kind of an audit of our own performance of the last decade. And I found we had actually joined at least 36 plurilateral, minilateral initiatives that I could count. Mm. And I suspect I would have missed a few in the last decade. And the reason that has happened is because the larger architecture is not able to deliver. So we believe today, you know, this year the Summit of the Future is coming up. It's a great opportunity to somewhere surcharge the reform process at a multilateral level. But if the powers who resist reform and resist change and want to keep the privileges of the past intact for themselves, then I think, you know, as you say, water always finds a way. I mean, I think politics also finds, power will find a way. I mean, different countries will just go and do their own thing.
And picking up on that, and something that you've mentioned in your book, your latest book as well, mm-hmm. You have drawn attention to the problems inherent in the global economic and international system, and this is something that you've been quite vocal about. And you've also stressed the need for a new re-globalization. What would a re-globalized world entail, and what would the implications of this be?
Well, Iqbal, I think if there was not just a moment of truth, but because it was actually a few years, it was actually the COVID experience. That when COVID happened, different countries, developing countries, least developed countries, developed countries, rich countries, all of us woke up to the enormous danger we had put ourselves into because of over-concentration of production. That if a significant part of the world's needs are manufactured in a very small, you know, very concentrated geography, you know, there are obvious risks. I mean, if you were running an enterprise, you would never do that. You know, you would never run a big organization relying on one factory. Now, we have put ourselves in that position for a variety of reasons. You know, some of it is geopolitical, some of it is, frankly, corporate short-sightedness. Some of it was prioritizing profitability over, in a sense, economic security. So, the lesson from the COVID era has been that there have to be more centers of production across the world. Now, you could take it in different spheres, you know. And part of it is also when, you know, production is over-concentrated, there's a natural temptation to weaponize it. So those who are at the receiving end of that weaponization also resent it. So in some cases, it's calculated. In some cases, it is disrupted logistics. But I think there's a huge demand across the world. You know, I see this in the global south. Many countries of the global south today want to have their basic health needs produced on site, locally, at least in the region. You know. So we are, I think, going to go through this process. It will be hastened by other factors. You know, we are moving into a world of AI. So data has become very sensitive. So who generates the data, who captures it, who processes it, who harnesses it, who monetizes it, who deploys it, all very important questions. So different countries, different societies are getting more sensitive. Many of them, like you said about multilateralism and doing your own thing, I think in terms of globalization also, you're going to have countries more and more focused on economic security. Economic security as equal to strategic autonomy. And the most powerful country in the world is going to lead the way. The United States is actually leading the way right now. So if the biggest country, which was the most ardent espouser of globalization, today is talking about its economic security, I would suggest to you, time to wake up and smell the coffee.
And you brought up the example of the United States, actually. Mm-hmm. If I move on that tangent now, I'm interested in hearing from you about how India's approach towards major powers has changed over the past decade. Let's start with the United States. What has changed in the way India deals with the United States?
Well, many things have changed. If I were to pick two or three big factors of change, first of all, you've had for the last decade a government in India which has not taken an ideological view of the United States, you know, because a lot of the hesitations on the Indian side, if you go back to the 1940s, 50s, 60s, were very strongly ideological when it came to the US. The second is that we have found in the Indian community an enormously effective bridge. So therefore, our willingness is more. The pathway has become broader in a way. Number three, there's a readjustment of the US and Indian positions or weight vis-a-vis each other. India has become much bigger. We are today the fifth largest economy. We were 11th just a decade ago. The gaps have started to close. The US today has also become more open-minded, So on the Indian side, less reservation, but on the US side also greater willingness. I mean, this is not the US which used to talk from up there to the rest of the world. This is today a much more pragmatic US, much more willing to work with other countries. So I would say the alignment of stars is getting stronger.
Picking up with the alignment of stars, looking ahead, what would be the key priorities for India in its relationship with the US?
It's such a broad-based and such a deep relationship today. I mean, there's virtually no area where I would say we don't have something to do with each other. My last complaint was cricket. Even that has been remedied because the Americans at Los Angeles will be introducing it into the Olympic Games. Mm. And we're going to have the T20 in that region, including the US. So nothing can be more symbolic of the convergence. But we today, for a country which did not buy any American platform, and America would not sell us. I mean, it's not just on our part. Mm. At that time, they also were operating on a different dynamic. Between 1965, for the next 40 years, there was virtually no Indian-American serious military interface. I mean, today, we operate, the C-17, the P-8s, the C-130s, four American helicopters, artillery from the US. We exercise, in fact, they're one of our major, perhaps the biggest exercise partner. When we look at the at the political side, at the diplomatic side, we work together in the UN, outside the UN. Many of our key plurilaterals are with the US, Quad, I2U2, IMEC. If one looks, look at a trend line, which country or which society is closer to which one? To me, it's like, who do you trade with? What are your investments up and down? What about education? What about tourism? What about diaspora? I think every index is pointing northwards.
Minister, moving on to a slightly trickier relationship now, India and China. India and China have not really had a smooth relationship historically, at least in the modern period. But things really took a dip after the border clashes of 2020. Has India changed in its approach towards China now, how it manages the relationship? But also, looking ahead, how do you see India-China relationship playing out?
Well, let me answer the looking ahead part, because the first part is a derivative of that. China has undergone an enormous change, by any description. We are also growing, a lot of our growth is still ahead of us. The challenge when two countries transform at such a rapid rate in an overlapping time frame, and they happen to also be neighbors, and they happen to be the only two countries in the world with more than 1 billion people, and also happen to be two of the world's oldest civilizations. I think you will understand the complexity of finding an equilibrium. But it is today the real challenge is how do India and China find that equilibrium? Now, so that's, in a way, you can say that's the goal. Work coming back to today, the starting point for an equilibrium at least is built on the foundation. And what was the foundation? The foundation where actually that though we have a boundary dispute, we have put in place enough mechanisms and understanding that the relationship will be stable, and wherever we can grow it, we'll grow it. Now, if that understanding is violated, so it isn't just, an incident we are talking about. There is today a fundamental issue we are facing. How do we address the disregard of agreements which were the basis, because peace and tranquility in the border areas was the basis for progress in the relationship, for the development of our ties. So I think that issue needs to be addressed, and that can be addressed only if there is respect for whatever has been agreed.
And if I could build on that, moving from the border clashes in the mountains to the maritime scenario, we know that China's presence within the Indian Ocean has expanded. Mm-hmm. Chinese naval capacities have expanded as well. Mm-hmm. And there's a view that at this same time, the US presence in the Indian Ocean has also decreased. Mm-hmm. How is India reading developments in the Indian Ocean?
Well, look, these are realities, what you are speaking about. I think for a country like India at this stage, the answer today is we grow our capabilities, our strength. That is why it's important the Make in India, especially in defense, it gathers greater force. We develop those technology strengths which are necessary for a lot of that. We also build the relationships in the region, So, because there are, you do not always compete by copying. You can compete by doing what you are good at doing. We do have one very important thing going for us, which is look at the geography of the Indian Ocean. There's a reason why it is called the Indian Ocean. So our centrality there, I think, is something which is very much to our advantage. How we use it is something that we are working on.
Another relationship that I'm sure you've answered many times before is the India-Russia relationship. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to take this question in a slightly different direction. Sure. India has maintained stable and friendly relations with Russia, and this has served India quite well historically.
And Russia.
And Russia, of course, yes. And at the same time, Russia has also developed a close relationship with China as well, the limitless friendship. Strategically, is there a reason for India to be concerned over a stronger Russia-China relationship, in which perhaps Russia could emerge as the junior partner to China?
Well, look, I think the era of exclusive relationships between, as a broad principle, between two big powers, or sometimes not even big powers, that era is slowly getting behind us. I think most significant players in world politics would have multiple relationships and would not allow it to be narrowed down to a exclusive nature. Now, it's a competitive world. Now, every country will try to get the best possible by having the strongest relationship with as many players and the least problems. So, for me, if I were to take off from your question, the answer therefore is make sure that India-Russia relationship remains strong. Not just remains strong, that it actually responds to the contemporary times. That wherever there are new complementarities that arise, for example, economic complementarities today, you use it to advantage. So, I cannot go about my business worrying that one country will get closer to another country. The best way of dealing with that is to say, I will do something on my part to ensure that my relationship is strong and secure. And that's exactly what we're doing.
Foreign policy is increasingly dealing with new sectors such as climate change, space technology, and technology in general, right? AI, mm-hmm. you sure. brought the issue of artificial intelligence up and digital connectivity. I'm wondering if, from India's perspective, if the private sector is an important aspect of India's foreign policy itself.
Well, you know, the Indian economic capability and technology capability is today a very visible part of a national capability. And that economic and technology capability is increasingly a private sector one. You know, when I travel around the world, there are many regions I go to where the image of Indians, the experience of Indians is actually Indian businesses who have gone out there. And we ourselves today, promote and facilitate our exports. We actually undertake development projects in 78 countries across the world. We fight for market access for our companies when it is denied, and it is that is unfortunately a problem in some places. Because at the end of the day, for us, all this means employment at home. It means economic growth at home. So I think today the relationship between the private sector and the government, there's a stronger sense of being a team. I think that's one of the big changes which has happened in India in the recent past.
And talking about the recent past, reflecting on last year's G20 presidentship of India, India pushed for an inclusive agenda.
Mm-hmm.
We know that India was not just vocal about it, but the things that were put on the table
sure.
included the views of not just the richest state
sure.
of the world, but also the global south.
Yes.
And there was a lot of discourse about the needs and necessities of the global south, but also the limitations and concerns that the global south
right.
faces as well. Looking ahead, how would India ensure that subsequent G20 hosting countries actually keep those issues on the table and serve the interests of the global
well,
south?
Well, you know, fortunately, in a way, I would say the luck or actually the cycle is in our favor, that we handed over the baton to Brazil. Brazil will go to from there to South Africa. So you have a certain period where you actually have global south countries who will be chairing the G20. But the other part of it is actually to keep the G20, to keep the global south itself alive, you know, to keep it aware, to keep it very active. My own sense is, you know, we did these two Voice of Global South summits during our G20 presidency. Today we are not, we are part of the Troika, but the presidency is with Brazil. But I think what we started off that with the Global South, I think that's acquired a life of its own. And I see, you know, that concept, a very large part of the world has embraced it enthusiastically. There are some countries who are very uncomfortable with it, which is also to me proof that it must be, there must be some value to it. I expect it to be a force. And certainly, you know, when we go into big summits, it could be COP or it could be Summit of the Future or, you know, issues like that. I think we'll see that sentiment express itself.
Minister, my final question for you. We are in Singapore now. And so it'll be remiss of me not to ask about Southeast Asia.
Please.
As well. India's relations with Southeast Asia have grown in recent years. Southeast Asia is trading more with India, but there are also exchanges in various realms. We know that India will be supplying missile systems to Philippines. India and Singapore have developed digital and financial inclusive and connectivity. Looking ahead, how important does ASEAN and Southeast Asia remain for India?
You know, I think it remains very important. In fact, in many ways, I would say it's even become more important. Why? As for us, the ASEAN relationship is very deeply associated with the beginnings of reform, you know, 1991-92. Secondly, by first turning to ASEAN, that opened the pathway to a further move towards the Pacific. I mean, in one way, I would say the look east and act east policies were actually the drivers of the Indo-Pacific. That the, if I were to give credit to the Indo-Pacific, I would really give credit to ASEAN. That the success of our ASEAN policies then allowed us to think beyond and bigger. Now, as we develop more capabilities and more interests and in ways more demands, in a good way, economic demands, we will see more points of convergence. India will certainly be an increasing source of technology in different domains. We are now taking manufacturing very seriously. So there will be, you know, we've seen defense exports from, I'm just giving you that as an example because you mentioned the case, expand. But it could be other areas, you know, our consumption of natural resources, of food, will also grow. We will be more globalized and will be one of the biggest contributors to the global workplace. So I see... And most, you know, for me, one of the most interesting things is actually connectivity. That today, because of the situation in Myanmar, what is a very, very important connectivity project, the trilateral highway, that has slowed down. But if I can get east of India, the trilateral highway and its extension all the way to the Vietnam coast done, and west of India, I can actually do a multimodal go across Arabian Sea, go through the Arabian Peninsula to Europe, I would actually be at the center of an Atlantic to Pacific lateral connectivity. Think about it. And ASEAN, there the India-ASEAN relationship will actually be the key. So this is for us, and then, you know, we have a degree of comfort here. Which is very, you know, which is historical, cultural, civilization. So I only, you know, see a good future, but like any future, however good, you have to work at it. There will always be, you know, process issues, the things we can do better, differently, faster. That's what people like me do for a living. But certainly, I'm very bullish about our ASEAN relationship.
On that optimistic note, Minister, thank you so much for joining us today. It's a pleasure.